From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Ann Kennedy, a contributing writer of the Christian Research Journal. So let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Ann Kennedy in their conversation.
I adore reading. I found that as I gave birth to one child and then another child and then another one, that my reading life disappeared, and I started to feel grief and sort of this hollow feeling inside. And one year, well, I think it came out early on, as soon as it was sort of in the mainstream, my husband bought me an Audible account, and I suddenly was able to listen to books while I was, you know, doing housework, while I was folding laundry and cooking and driving people in the car. And that, you know, I found that I was sort of getting through books at a very quick rate that way, and I thought, oh, well, I wonder if I could go back and read a book now without falling asleep as soon as I open the cover. And I could. It helped that I was not nursing a baby at that point, and so I wasn't really, really sleep deprived. But I began to push myself. And so now, between Audible, listening, and reading, which I am able to do, I'm able to read now at the pace I did when I was younger. You know, I can quickly get through a book that I'm not very interested in, and then I can read books that I know need more time and space more slowly. So I am able to go between different kinds of reading as well, just fun novels and more serious theology and, you know, some of the more current things that come out. I agree with Lewis so much that the diet of new books should be much less than the diet of old books. But I got, I think last year, up to 75 books between reading and listening, and I think I'm going to be able to do that again this year. I wanted to get to 100, but I have still too many children who want to talk to me, so I'm not going to make my goal, which is probably good.
When you say make your goal, I mean, one of the things you're writing about in this article is the people that make resolution somewhere in the time frame of December, January. I'm going to do this in the following year. Next year, I'm going to read X amount of books, or next year, I'm going to lose X amount of pounds, whatever it happens to be. What's your perspective on making New Year's resolutions?
I am always wanting to make a lot of resolutions. I am charmed by the idea. I always want to be a better person than I am. I think it's partly insecurity that spurs me on, and partly jealousy of other people who seem to have their lives together. But I do like making resolutions. I have never been very good at keeping them. It's only, I think, been with reading, which I really wanted to do, that I've been able to make a goal and then sort of keep track and keep pace so that it was realistic and I actually could do it. And it's funny because my husband, who also reads so much and is very disciplined, never makes any resolutions and thinks that, well, he laughs. I mean, I write them all out and I track them by year, and then I look at them in December and I find that I wasn't that good. And he thinks that's ridiculous and you should just live and not worry about that kind of thing. But I don't believe in self-improvement, goals as improving yourself, but maybe goals as, or resolutions to, you know, push out of the despair that I think modern life sometimes brings. You shouldn't settle into the sense of ennui that many of us have, but try to work a little bit to get out of that place. That sort of self-improvement, I think, is worthy even for the Christian.
Well said. An article that I found very fascinating, this is an article that anyone can read, it's on the web at equip.org, It's your article on African traditional religion, Black Lives Matter, and the prosperity gospel. And there are so many takeaways from that particular article. One of the takeaways, maybe not the most important takeaway, but one of them that I'd like you to comment on is the concept of time that is prevalent in many places such as Africa. It's a different way of counting time. So, for example, if you go to many churches in Africa, if you're a guest, you might be there on time, but if you're a native to the country, you might not show up for a while.
That is very true. My family learned that slowly over the years. We were often in church right when the stated time, say 10 o'clock in the morning, that's maybe it was posted on the side of the building, but nobody would be there until 11:30, or, you know, people drifted in and drifted out. Yes, the African sense of time, and in other parts of the world as well, is very different than the industrial Western view that you are a servant of time in the West. And time isn't something that you have. You can maybe hack your life to get more of it. It's a commodity. It's something precious. But it's not something that very many people have a sense of control over. And that is very different from the way that people in Africa view time, for the most part, although as people move to the cities, it changes. But in Africa, most people feel that time is something that you make. It's something that can come into being. So an event starts when all the people who are important to that event arrive. If a funeral were to happen, the funeral wouldn't begin until everyone had come. And it doesn't really matter, you know, what the clock says. It's the people who are there that make the time. And many people have written about it. And of course, a huge continent like that, you can't be too generalizing about whether people have a clear sense of the future or the past in the way that Western people do. There's tomes, there's so many fascinating books to read on that subject about how to translate the idea of time from culture to culture. But the thing that I loved as I read about this topic was that you don't have to be a servant of time. Time could be a servant to you. I don't know how to enact that in my own life, but I really wish that I could.
You know, there's so much in the title of this article. Let's start with African traditional religion. I imagine a lot of people would wonder, why in the world is this important for a Christian in the West to be up on? And I think you have a very good answer to that question. This is something that is starting to permeate Western culture.
With the rise of the nuns in America, the generation of people who don't claim any particular religion, per se, and are disaffected, they feel, by Christianity. They might have been Christian before, but they would not identify themselves that way now. As I read about it, more and more people are sort of willing to take from here and there what they think works for them. And for many people, that is including what is technically called African traditional religion. I mean, the whole continent of Africa has its own particular religions in each and every place, but broad themes can be traced from one language group to another. But it's interesting to find that some of those broad themes and some of the peculiar details are making their way into American religion. So if you were to Google ATR or, you know, maybe power, you might get a very interesting set of blog posts about Nigerian religion and how to do that as an American, how to tap into the spiritual realm that people in Nigeria might find meaningful for them. And there's no real worry about, you know, cultural appropriation is a big deal right now. But it seems like it's okay to take bits and pieces from other religious views in other parts of the world and bring them here and use them, and that's not troubling or problematic. I thought that was really interesting. Yeah, I think it's growing. I do think that Christians should know what it is because it does have a resonance with the prosperity gospel in Africa and here, and it would be good to be able to spot it and know where it's coming from and be able to talk to people evangelistically, I think, would be really helpful.
Why is there such an appeal for the prosperity gospel in Africa? I remember for years reading about the impact that Reinhard Bonnke had in Africa. He would get the masses worked up, and his message was singularly, I would say, a prosperity message.
I think one of the main reasons is because around the world, but in Africa particularly, people want a religious system that will work. They want to know why things happen, and they want to be able to affect a good outcome.
Stay right there. We'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Christian Research Journal contributing writer Ann Kennedy. Skeptics complain that if God really loved us, he would make his existence and presence unmistakable. Yet for us to have a robust free will, there must be an amount of divine hiddenness or epistemic distance. God gives us enough evidence of his existence that those who want to worship him will have their beliefs justified, but not so much evidence that those who don't want to worship him will be compelled to feign loyalty. Be sure to read Four Types of Divine Hiddenness by Clay Jones in the current issue of the Christian Research Journal. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today, and in addition to receiving the print edition, you'll also receive access to online exclusive articles. Call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or just go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making, and based on two decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking. It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence. Order Has God Spoken? From the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Equip. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org. Here again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Ann Kennedy, as they continue their conversation.
People want a religious system that will work. They want to know why things happen, and they want to be able to affect a good outcome. So African traditional religion is a religious system that is very practical. It's not pie in the sky. It does provide reasons for why things happen or where you will go when you die, for instance. But there are ways to get what you want from the spiritual realm. And that is what the prosperity gospel teaches. If you, by your own faith power or praying certain kinds of things, should be able to get the outcome you desire from God, maybe rather you don't believe in the ancestors or the spirits, but God is conceived of in a similar kind of way. So I do think it's a very easy marriage between ATR and prosperity teaching. It fits together pretty nicely, more than other kinds of religious ideas.
It's such an incredibly potent force. I mean, when you start to say that faith is a force, words are the containers of the force, and through the force of faith, you create your own reality. In particular contexts where people are desperate to tap into this force by giving their money to these evangelistic organizations. I mean, it's real manipulation. It's dangerous. And obviously leaves people in the end destitute because it overpromises and underperforms. There's also a connection, as you point out, between African traditional religion and Black Lives Matter.
Yes, this is not very much known, but the person who started the Black Lives Matter movement is somebody who uses that kind of religious system. And if you go and look at many of the kinds of rituals that different BLM rallies have had, there have been little, not very well noticed elements of ATR, of pouring out libations, of invoking the ancestors, even thinking of power in a way that isn't conversant for most Western Americans. And they've been fairly open about it, but I don't think people have noticed it very much. I don't think most people who are part of Black Lives Matter are not thinking African traditional religion, but there is an invitation by people in the upper parts of the organization, an invitation to that kind of spiritual realm and that way of thinking about the spirits and the ancestors and God. And I found that to be really fascinating. I don't know what the outfall of that is or if it will be something that continues. But I would caution people, of course I don't ascribe to the idea of Black Lives Matter or their political philosophy is something I think Christians should run away from. But even to those in the organization, I would say I wouldn't dabble in that. I don't think you know where that could lead you. It seems like a really dangerous idea, but I'm curious to see how that will play out in the years to come.
Again, the article, African Traditional Religion, Black Lives Matter, and the Prosperity Gospel, you can find it on the web at equip.org. One of the things you gather immediately when you follow Ann Kennedy is that you are an animal lover. And I want to talk about that a little bit because there is a proper way to relate to animals and there's an improper way to relate to animals. For example, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, the PETA organization, often elevates animals to fellow beings on a level playing field with humanity. In fact, bioethics professor Peter Singer actually says that a disabled newborn has less value than a chimpanzee. So there's a proper way to relate to animals and an improper way to relate to animals. And there are many people in the Christian world that love animals just like you do. I think of Johnny Erickson Tata. She's an animal lover. C.S. Lewis was an animal lover. Many people have written about how significant animals are in God's creation. They were there at the beginning. And many theologians believe that they will be in the eternal garden as well. I'd like to get a little more of your perspective on this.
Well, I think I was asked to write about this year because along with all the other heartbreaks of COVID, we lost early on a cat that we loved, and then my dog died this year. And I was shocked by how much that grief affected me, even though, you know, many people I know and love died this year, including some family. And I was very sad. I shouldn't say that was very grievous and difficult. But somehow, when our dog died, I just totally came unglued. It took me weeks to get myself back together. And I was curious about why that was. And I dug up an old sermon that I loved years ago by John Wesley. And he makes a really interesting, fascinating theological proposition, really, that the way that we relate to animals says something about how things were supposed to be before the way that God relates to us. We were supposed to tend the garden and care for it and care for the animals. He says, in some sense, we were meant to be God to them. And the way that God cares for us, we were supposed to care for them. And of course, we sinned, and so we are not able to do that. And so part of the overwhelming grief that many of us feel when an animal is suffering or dies is that that's a failure. That primordial failure comes back into view. And it's not just that our animal died, it's that we also, you know, we failed that particular animal. It's sort of a double grief. But the way out is, I think, he would say, to worship God, not to worship the created order, which I think is something more and more people are choosing to do. They're elevating animals into the place of humans and then really of God as well. To worship God and to admit the helplessness that is our estate as humans and beg for God's mercy and look forward to the hope that he will restore all of creation, including the parts that we, you know, failed to care for. And I really liked in The Great Divorce Lewis's picture of one of the characters. She took care of many, many people in her life, but she also had a whole assortment of animals that she fed from her back door and took care of, and they all are with her in heaven. Is a very hopeful, I don't know, it's Lewis being imaginative, but I really hope that it's true.
Well, I certainly hold out for that same hope, and I live in a family of animal lovers. Trust me, if you were in our house, you'd recognize how much we love animals. Sometimes I can't count the number of cats, and my wife and kids purposely lie to me about the numbers. I mean, they always diminish the numbers, but I find out there's actually more cats in the house than I ever thought there might be. Anyway, gaslighting. Maybe I was just gaslighting my wife there. But anyway, gaslighting in the age of social media. You know a lot about the internet. You know a lot about gaslighting. A lot of people might not know what gaslighting is. Can you explain that to us?
One of the great charms of the internet age is that the ability to confuse someone and make them feel crazy, which has always been part of the human experience, is now available to everyone and on steroids, really. Since the beginning of time, one of the best ways to make somebody go nuts is to lie to them in subtle ways so that they become confused and they begin to question what they know. The term comes from a play, and then two movies were made out of it. They're both really good, and I keep confusing them because they were only made 2 years apart from each other, but they both have that name, and they're kind of black and white thrillers. They're both really good. And you see in the film how somebody can make another person go crazy by making them question their sense of reality and what's going on. So it's lying, but it's a subtle form of lying, and you can do it accidentally. Most people don't set out to gaslight each other, but if your view of something is so essential, you can't possibly see that the other person might see it differently. after a while, you could probably make them go crazy. So I think the best example of gaslighting today is social media, which is where everyone just makes everyone else feel crazy all the time. But you can see it if somebody is going along using one word, but then you realize that they've changed the definition of the word in the course of the conversation, or you thought that you were talking about one set of things, but then you realize that everybody introduced different ideas about what that was, and now you're crazy. If you have a sense that you are going crazy, you're going nuts, it's possible that in an online conversation, somebody is gaslighting you. It's really a helpful word, I think, because it's how we're having theological discussions today, is with this very subtle, kind of insidious changing of definitions. A big one would be, you know, the word inclusion for a long time meant one thing, or even diversity. And then somewhere in the 90s, early 2000s, the word inclusion came to mean something else. And everybody was, most people were using it still in one sense, but gradually it came to have this other meaning. And the people who wanted to use it in its original sense felt themselves going crazy and were eventually, you know, ostracized.
We'll have to stop here for today's edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Ann Kennedy. To read Ann Kennedy's print and online exclusive articles, subscribe to the Christian Research Journal when you call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI, Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.